Welcome to Two-Way Street. We're going to devote today's show to conversations with two authors who've written new books about dogs. First, we'll talk about a breed that's viewed with fear and apprehension by many people. Later, we'll hear inspiring stories about dogs who are heroes to their mentally and physically challenged human partners. Let's start with Bronwyn Dickey. She's at the center of a storm of controversy and has even been the target of death threats because in her new book, Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon, she argues that as a breed, pit bulls are no more dangerous than any other dog. Her book tracks how a dog that was once beloved as an all-American family favorite became demonized in the latter half of the 20th century. Pitbull. The title of your book alone, Bronwyn, is sort of like captivating because the word itself seems charged to me. Yes?
Absolutely. And that's part of the reasons the subtitle is The Battle Over an American Icon, because whether you love them or hate them, everyone seems to have an opinion.
Your way in to the world of the pit bull, you tell us, is that a few years back, you and your husband, Sean, brought home a pit bull that was called Nola, right? Tell us about Nola.
Well, actually, the story started a little earlier in 2008 when I was doing a piece on the Chattooga River, actually, up near Clayton. And one of my friends, the head of the Chattooga Conservancy, he had a black pit bull named Angel. And it was the only pit bull I had ever spent any time around. Before that, I had been terrified of them. But she was this wonderful, very sensitive and affectionate dog. So I started, I guess the kind of journalistic curiosity got piqued, and I started researching them a little bit. And I found that veterinarians and behaviorists and all the people in the animal sciences said that this pit bull stuff was mostly hype and that we really kind of needed to discard it because it was doing a lot of damage and a lot of animals were dying that shouldn't, that didn't need to be. So then after that, my husband and I adopted one from our local shelter, and she was... I thought she was very kind of shy and unimpressive in a way. She didn't stand out to me, but she just kind of looked at us and we knew.
You say something really interesting about Nola. I'm still not quite sure why we did it, but I do remember an unnerving sense of recognition when she looked at me through her chain link kennel.
Yeah, it's one of those things that is very hard to explain, kind of the ineffable part of the human canine bond. The dogs I had owned previously, including the dog that we still have, our pug, our Oscar, they had always been very friendly, but I never felt that kind of real locked-in connection. And it was the difference between, you know, a good friend and falling in love, I think. You just feel like you're home.
And Nola looked you right in the eye?
She did, yeah.
Which, you know, there's always this notion that dogs don't like to look at humans.
Right.
Now, our dog at home
looks
at us all the time.
Right.
We lock eyes with some regularity.
Right,
yeah.
Right. There are so many subtleties to canine behavior. It's amazing. And even the eye contact thing. There's been this great body of research now that shows us that even when we're not looking at dogs, they are watching our eyes. They're watching the sclera of our eyes to see where we're moving, where they're moving and where we're looking. It's amazing.
You mentioned an essay that you say is a classic essay by John Berger called Why Look at Animals. Why is that essay important in terms of what happened with you and Nola?
Sure. Well, one of the things Berger says in the essay is that, you know, the animal looks at us across this abyss of non-comprehension. And when we look back at animals, we're looking across ignorance and fear. And I think that's something that became really relevant to my project as I started thinking about pit bulls and spending time with pit bulls. There was so much ignorance and fear that it sometimes felt that I was rowing across an entire ocean of it to get there.
You say the term pit bull is an elastic, imprecise, and subjective phrase. At its narrower end, it denotes one breed, the American pit bull terrier, which did originate as a fighting dog.
It sure did.
How did that happen? What was the pit bull terrier all about in the beginning?
They go back to at least 1800. in England, and then were kind of brought over here with English and Irish immigrants. And especially in kind of the gangs of New York heyday, they were certainly fighting dogs in the fighting pits there, whether ratting or fighting.
This was a dog that was used with cattle initially.
Oh, yeah. The original bulldogs, yeah. That goes back to the 17th century,
okay.
Or even beyond.
Let's talk about that,
sure.
Just a little bit, because it's really interesting.
I don't know how much of my nerddom you want here. The original bulldogs were used in bull baiting rings in medieval England, and that was a really grisly practice that for a while was mandated by the laws in order for butchers to sell bull meat, which was tough. The meat had to be kind of tenderized via the bull being baited such that lactic acid kind of built up in the muscles and made it more tender, which is just so grim. But that became a popular form of gambling in medieval England. Queen Elizabeth was a huge fan of baiting. She hosted foreign dignitaries at the baiting pits. She was really into bear baiting, so the bulldogs would be set on bears and such. And it's just a very, very kind of dark moment in history.
You describe Queen Elizabeth as kind of being gleeful about watching
the dogs. Oh, yes. She laughed. It was said she laughed like a schoolgirl. I mean, it was just such a different time. And kind of as I say in the book, it's so hard for us to imagine this, but this was also the era of public executions and, you know, people attending hangings for fun. So it was just a completely different time. But there were always more people that owned these dogs than were using them for terrible purposes, fortunately. They were just kind of, again, medium-sized, generic, and easy to house, easy to have around, especially for the working class. They were kind of all-purpose farm dogs, and they just kind of became more and more popular as a working class symbol.
When we talk about pit bulls, and when we look at pit bulls,
right.
You point out we really don't know what we're talking about or what we're seeing, correct?
Right. It's... Again, you ask 100 people what a pit bull is, and they'll give you 100 different answers. And that was kind of one of the real challenging parts of this research.
So what's interesting about that is, on one side, you have the people who love this particular breed of
right.
dog, who
right.
are very clear about the exclusive
right.
Nature of which dog they're talking
right.
about. And on the other side, you have people who are terrified of pit bulls
right.
and lump into their fear lots of dogs that really don't belong
right.
there.
Right, at least 25 different breeds, and that's not counting mixed breed dogs. If we can't even define what these animals are, then that's a very good sign that a lot of the rhetoric is about symbolism and not necessarily a specific animal. And you really have to wonder, since there's no science behind any of this, you know, what is this really about for us? And more than anything, I think it's the need to kind of carve out something so that we know what to be afraid of, you know?
I think that's a great moment for us to go back a little
sure,
now and
sure.
talk about the history of the pit bull,
sure.
especially in
yeah.
the United States. In the 1920s, you describe bulls and terriers as very positive symbols used in advertising because they were believed to be so friendly and cuddly, whatever
right,
the words
right.
are.
They were a lot like the Horatio Alger character, you know, the kind of guy who might come from the streets, but if he works hard enough, he can become the president of the company. Kind of, you see that a lot in the literature of that time. And even though, as you mentioned before, even though they did start out as fighting dogs, fighting is such an extreme endeavor that the washout rate is very, very high. There are only a tiny number of dogs, even dogs that have been purpose-bred for the task, that can actually do that. It's just a very unnatural pursuit. In the latter part of the 19th century, all those washouts were seen as really fun, fine family pets, just kind of average dogs. It was a rejection of all the kind of fussy pedigree breeds and the highborn, expensive dogs that were the fashion among high society. It was just the kind of rough and tumble all-American, the yeah. dog with the patch over his eye.
Yeah, yeah. Our gang kids
mm-hmm.
had a... Was that a bull terrier? I want to make sure
no,
I get
it was
right.
It was an American pit bull terrier.
It was a pit bull.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was a pedigreed pit bull.
You talk about these dogs being fighting dogs.
Mm.
But let's be careful about how we describe that, because that might suggest to some people that this is a dog that is hardwired
exactly.
to be a fighting animal.
One of the things that I found most important in this entire process was that the kind of over-assumption that all pit bulls have been quote, bred for fighting or have had some involvement in that world could not be further from the truth. In fact, even when it was legal, it was only something like between 1 and 10% of pit bull dogs were actually matched that way.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Bronwyn Dickey about her new book, Pitbull. This is Two Way Street.
Let me in, so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more, so get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in. Doghouse here is mighty small, but it's better than no house at all. So ease it on over.
Move it on over.
Drag it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, old dog, cause our new dog's moving in.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Bronwyn Dickey. Her new book is Pitbull. When we left off, Dickey was describing how the pit bull was a beloved family favorite until sometime near the middle of the 20th century. And then, she says, things changed.
Well, it kind of, you know, it really got going in the 1970s, but it almost started a little before that in the 1950s. In the 1950s, Americans were so flush with cash, and it was the age of consumerism and brands and brand name cars, brand name washing machines, brand name everything. And part of the all-American suburban dream was at that point to have an AKC, you know, pedigreed dog. So the AKC registrations kind of exploded, and these kind of average dog with the patch over his eye, all-American country farm dog types were much less appealing. So they kind of faded out of the spotlight a little bit until the 1970s, when there was this very well-intentioned, and I always feel that I have to underline that, very well-intentioned effort by the humane movement to make dog fighting a major public issue and to pass federal laws that would make it a federal crime so that these people could be more easily apprehended. But in doing that, since so few Americans knew anything about dog fighting, the rhetoric just started getting more and more extreme about how many dog fighters there were, how widespread this pursuit was, how monstrous the animals were. Things just got really out of hand, and there was so much speculation instead of fact that it just snowballed into this kind of nightmare where within a few years, instead of a victim of a terrible form of torture, the dogs were portrayed as mutants. What's sad and interesting at the same time about that is that the press kind of acted like people who were doing illicit things had just discovered dogs or something in 1980, when in fact anyone who's ever been involved in any illicit operation throughout American history has always been partial to a certain type of dog. So in Al Capone's day, bootleggers, I found tons of articles about bootleggers and their German police dogs or German shepherds. And those were kind of the bane of city life then. And then in the 1970s, whether it was, you know, drugs or the KKK or the Hell's Angels, they had their German Shepherds and their Dobermans and stuff. This idea that this was a unique phenomenon, there had always been dogs at these operations. It just happened that the dog changed and the story was more titillating.
It's interesting. As I was reading your book, and I thought about that, I thought when I was much younger, it was the German Shepherd that I was most afraid of. And yet the German Shepherd, because there was an image about the Shepherd as being an attack dog, a watchdog that could attack at a moment's notice, and yet it's probably, is it the single most popular breed in American families? Or it's certainly
it's
way up there,
it's always up there. It's always way up there. And because there are so many positive images of German Shepherds to balance that out, you have Rin Tin Tin. You have police dogs and military dogs, and they're seen as these wonderful protectors. That was enough to kind of buffer some of the negative stuff that was swirling around it. But by the time the pit bull kind of was slotted into the spotlight in this negative way, all those memories of Petey and stuff were very far behind.
Yeah. You say that media went nuts about pit bulls. Mm-hmm. And there were, I think, is it Time Magazine had a cover of a snarling pit bull? One of them.
Sports Illustrated.
Sports Illustrated. Mm-hmm. Really nasty looking pit bull on the, with teeth bared and that.
Yeah, the same week or the same month, rather. Sports Illustrated, the dog was on the cover. There were big features in Time and People and Rolling Stone about how monstrous these terrible dogs were. And I think between those four publications at that time, 1987, their combined readership was something like 120 million people.
One of the reasons this really becomes important is that you had cities that started banning pit bulls.
So, yeah, they banned them, and those bans usually resulted in a whole bunch of dogs being rounded up and killed, dogs that hadn't done anything.
Another sociological aspect of all this is that you talk about the dog becoming a symbol of the hip-hop culture.
For sure. It's just that the way that relationship was portrayed and packaged made a segment of white America very frightened. It can't really be understated how much the vilification of the quote inner city dealer and all that coded racial language like thug and gangster and all that stuff that goes along with that, how much the dogs became a proxy for those racial tensions.
Yeah. To kind of sum up about your book, it struck me as I was reading it that what you've done here is write a book about prejudice.
I hope so.
Whether it's about dogs, people, this is a book about how stereotypical images can get out of control and can cause us to turn against people, dogs, that don't deserve what they're getting. Is that fair? Is this a book about prejudice?
Yes. I think you hit the nail on the head. And it keeps us from solving the real problems that we have right in front of us. Say, for instance, the focus on pit bulls keeps us from solving the real problems with individual dogs that are legitimately dangerous. If you're diverting all your resources to animal control officers going and hunting down people's pit bulls that haven't done anything, those officers are not around to deal with the actual dogs who are becoming dangerous, whatever breed they may be. I think it gives us a false sense of security, but it also blinds us to the solutions we could really be coming up with. And that's what prejudice does all across the board. We think of breeds as clones when, in fact, you know, if I said Georgians, what are Georgians like? What are Atlantans like? You'd really have to say, well, which ones? We have so many people here. We have so many families. We have this huge, diverse population. So which ones are you talking about? And that's kind of what we're doing with breeds.
So when I see that pit bull at the Humane Society, you're suggesting I shouldn't worry any more about the potential for that dog to be violent, to be aggressive, than any other dog.
Everything really is in the individual dog in front of you. You know, that's the thing to pay attention to. What is your relationship like with that individual dog? Because it's the individual dog, that dog's temperament and background, meeting the individual human and the relationship between them that makes the biggest difference.
Well, but even in terms of that, at one point in the book, you say that you were amazed when you recognized that despite terrible mistreatment in some cases, terrible mistreatment, how often dogs end up being loving and kind and easy to deal with. That's fascinating. You're talking about the resilience of a spirit.
Oh, yeah. And the resilience of a spirit over 35,000 years. I mean, there's no reason why two predators should have partnered up over the course of evolution and grown and changed each other and made civilization possible. But yeah, when people say, I think they're well-intentioned, but when they say it's all how you raise them, I always want to say, well, look at all the dogs who are, quote, raised in horrendous conditions, and they still end up being resilient. I mean, that's the nature of the domestic dog. It is a highly affiliative creature. It wants to be with us. That is what it is.
How's Nola doing?
She's doing great. She's doing.
How old is she now?
She's six.
And your other dog is?
Oscar the pug. The senile pug.
They get along well.
They get along quite well.
Okay, good.
She
I just want to make sure.
She takes good care of them. Yes, yes. She takes very good care of them. There's a core group of people who believe that pit bulls are unnatural, mutants, baby killers, etc. It's been really interesting in terms of looking at their reactions, because so many of the points they're angriest about, they don't seem to have read the book, and so many of the points they're the angriest about are things I never say, or things points I would never defend. I would never
really?
Excuse.
Social media not being accurate?
It's amazing, right? I mean, mind blown. But, you know, it's hurtful. It's cruel. A lot of them have mentioned my father in very cruel ways. You know, things like, of course, he drank himself to death. Look who his daughter is. Stuff like kind of like that. Or mentioning things about my mother and saying I'm unstable. I mean, it's the level of cruelty, I think, that people are willing to indulge online. It has been kind of a revelation to me, but in a way it really proves my point, in that if this is what we're willing to do to each other over this issue, instead of coming together and learning from each other and having a real conversation, then that says something that doesn't have anything to do about dogs.
Can you make a difference with this book? Can you start to make a difference?
I don't know, but I do hope that readers who pick it up will see it as kind of one small case study in critical thinking, the unpacking of one stereotype. And I hope that will aid them when they are confronted with others in their lives. I think it's possible that we're entering a very scary time in terms of being afraid of the other, you know, of being afraid of certain groups. There's a lot of nasty rhetoric going on out there. And we need to be very careful about how we approach that. And we need to call it out when we see it.
Bronwyn Dickey, I'm going to go pet a pit bull later today just because of you.
Make sure it's a nice one.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Bronwyn Dickey's book is Pit Bull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Shortly after my conversation with Dickey, my wife Janice and I adopted a 10-month-old puppy from the Atlanta Humane Society. We named him Uncle Gus, and while he does have a little pit bull in him, we're told, he's the sweetest dog we have ever had in our home. If you go to the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS or our Facebook page, we've posted a video of Uncle Gus there. And we'd love it if you'd post pictures of your dogs on our Facebook page. We'll be back after a break to talk about dogs doing miraculous things to help people in need. Welcome back to Two Way Street. We're talking today about dogs. Melissa Faye Green is a celebrated author who's written books as far-ranging as the story of a struggle for civil rights in a South Georgia town to a book about a notorious hate crime that targeted a synagogue that was a center of Jewish life in Atlanta. But her new book is about dogs, and specifically about the remarkable work being done by an Ohio organization called Four Paws for Ability. They train dogs to assist people with severe mental and physical challenges. Melissa Faye Green, let's talk about the underdogs, children, dogs, and the power of unconditional love. I love that title. There were two quotes in the book that popped out at me. One of them is Will Rogers. What's the great Will Rogers quote that you mention in your book?
He said, "If dogs don't go to heaven, then when I die, I want to go to wherever they went."
The other quote that I loved was Henry Ward Beecher, which really strikes me as being right on point with your book. What did Henry Ward Beecher, the great abolitionist 19th century preacher, say about dogs?
The dog was made specially for children. He is the god of frolic. That was my title for the book, The Gods of Frolic. And for the years that I was writing this book, it was always with that title. But
why the underdogs?
I was not looking for this. I love dogs. I've always loved dogs. It never occurred to me to write about them. But I was approached by a local woman, Donnie Winokur, a few years ago, and she had a big golden retriever with her. And halfway through her story, I said, would you want me to write about this? And she said, would you? Her story was that she and her husband, Rabbi Harvey Winokur of Roswell, had faced infertility and in their 40s had adopted two children from Russia, a baby named Marusha and a toddler named Ayal, a little boy. Marusha developed into a bright, happy little girl, but Ayal was troubled and difficult and unpredictable and woke up in the night raging and would come storming through the house, waking up his parents, and didn't understand the meaning of the word no. And the bigger he got, the more unruly. They said for the first year or so, the difficulties with Ayal still were, they thought, just adjustment problems. God has given us children, and their joy was so great. But he got more and more peculiar. He would drop to the floor and try to kiss the toes of strangers. And he was wildly out of control, throwing gigantic tantrums triggered by odd things. He didn't want his mother touching his food. He said he could smell her on it. Certain pieces of her jewelry set him off. If she forgot to take the sticker off his banana, he could rage for hours. He would cross his arms, sit down hard, and just kick his legs and scream and scream. When he was 4 and a half, they got a terrible diagnosis, and the diagnosis was fetal alcohol syndrome, FAS. His birth mother had been a drinker while pregnant with him, and it's an irreversible, brutal kind of brain damage. Donnie, the mom's interest in publishing and interest in my telling the story was to get the message out to pregnant young women, don't drink. There's no safe amount, and the plague it visits on the child is irreversible.
Am I right to assume it was the Winokurs, Donnie Winokur, and your conversation with her that led you to learn about Karen Shirk, the founder of Four Paws for Ability? Yes?
Exactly. Four Paws was one of the first in the world to train dogs, not just for children, but for children with what they call invisible disabilities, like seizure disorder, autism. Donnie called and said, do you place dogs with children with fetal alcohol syndrome? What's that? Donnie explained it. And the director, Karen Shirk, said, yeah, I think we can do that. Donnie was stunned. Every other door had slammed in their faces. Nothing could help Ayal, they were told. And it was stunningly good news for the Winokurs. And within the year, after fundraising and training and going to work with the dog, they met Chancer, a rescue golden retriever who had received 500 hours of training, the last 100 hours of which were specifically for Ayal and the Winokur family. They bring this dog home, just a goofy-looking, jolly, big old, you know, friendly golden retriever. And within the first couple of days, Ayal is throwing a fit about something. He sees a paper napkin on the floor, or he sees his sister's Barbie, crosses his arms, sits down, starts to rail and bang his head. And now the parents say to Chancer, disrupt. One of the things the trainers in Ohio tell the families is that the dogs, and every dog is trained for a child with different issues, of course, the dogs aren't disapproving. The dogs aren't thinking, oh my God, what's with this child? No, the dogs, for the dogs, when they hear a command, the dogs are hearing game on. So they say to Chancer, disrupt. He's hearing game on. So he gallops over to Ayal as he was trained, and he noses through Ayal's crossed arms from underneath, opens up the arms, starts licking and licking, licking his way up the neck onto the face, and Ayal starts laughing. If Ayal is resistant and wants to keep screaming, Chancer can knock him over and climb on top of him, and he'll lick him and pin him there until Ayal abandons the tantrum.
So tell us about Karen Shirk. She herself dealt with a debilitating illness that led her to realize there was power in dogs working with people who had significant physical or emotional problems, right?
Karen Shirk was a college student in the 1990s, crossing campus one day and suddenly collapsed without warning, fell to the sidewalk, could not move, could barely breathe, was rushed to the hospital, and in time, all systems failing, ultimately was diagnosed with a rare neuromuscular disease, a genetic syndrome with onset in the 20s, spent most of that year in a hospital, and then was moved to a long-term nursing facility. So she went from being a vibrant young woman to being a long-term, bedridden disability patient on a ventilator. Several years later, a new nurse coming into this nursing home, looking at this pale, isolated, lonely, depressed young woman, said, why don't you get a dog? Why don't you apply for a service dog? The nurse had seen service dogs bring patients back to life. And she said, you could handle a service dog. A service dog would help you. A service dog would help you get dressed and undressed and bring you things. So Karen agreed, and they applied ultimately to every service dog agency in the country. And every single one said no. Every single agency wrote back and said, you are too disabled. She spiraled into depression, started stockpiling morphine, just said this is a long, slow decline into death. But the following year, the nurse said, Karen, for the love of God, why don't you just get your own damn dog? The nurse said, get up. We're going to go look at puppies, and got Karen into a wheelchair, into a van, and they began visiting puppies. They brought home an all-black German shepherd dog, a puppy. Karen named him Ben, and they hired trainers. Karen's not a dog trainer. He got his basic puppy work, and then he became a magnificent service dog. He dragged Karen back to life the same way dogs drag back to life people with post-traumatic stress disorder who don't want to leave their room. The puppy has to be taken out. You have to go. So Karen more and more had to crawl out of her bed into the wheelchair, had to go outside to take the puppy on walks. By the end of the year, new meds had allowed her to come off the ventilator, and she was returning to life. With Ben at her side, they moved out of the nursing home, rented a little house of their own. She got a job, and at that point, she looked back and said, wow, how many people are stranded like I was because no service dog agency would give them a dog?
Well, before we get to the next step in her life, you describe in your book a remarkable incident that you can't quite explain, and nevertheless, it is what it is. What did Ben do for Karen when she had a crisis that could have killed her?
She had returned home from the hospital following heart surgery. She had almost full-time nursing aid, but not full-time. So there was a nurse with her through most of the day, but she had to get through the 8 hours of night herself. She was on a pump that was pumping in the painkillers. And one night the pump malfunctioned and began pumping such strong painkillers into Karen's system that she plunged into the state of shock. The phone rang, and it was her father making his nightly phone call to check on her. But on this night, she was too drugged and slipping away fast to answer. Ben was trained that when Karen said, answer, Ben would pick up the receiver and bring it to Karen. But on this night, Karen didn't say answer. And if Karen didn't give the command, Ben was supposed to let the phone ring into the answering machine. She was unconscious, but Ben picked up the receiver, dropped it on the bed, and started barking. The father was saying, Karen, is Karen there? Ben, is Karen there? And Ben kept barking and barking and barking. The father then hung up and called 911, and they got there in the nick of time. Did Ben know what he was doing? I mean, no one knows. Did Ben save her life? Ben saved her life. Ben saved her life in so many ways, including that night. What she says about it is some things about dogs are just beyond explanation. They're just magical. When Karen started with the thought, how many people are stuck like I was, she was thinking, why can't I rescue and hire trainers for 4 or 5 dogs a year? And I'll place them with people who are being told, no, you are too disabled to get a dog. And that was over 1,000 dogs ago. This past spring, they placed their 1,000th dog. The vast majority go to children with disabilities and their families, but a small percentage go to military vets with PTSD.
I'd like to talk about the underpinning to me of this entire book. You believe, I think, we have undervalued the relationship between human beings and dogs.
For most of the 20th century, scientists did not believe that non-human animals could think or feel. Now, non-scientists who love animals don't have that issue. People who spend time with animals believe that they also have thoughts and feelings. Scientists did not. There was a pushback coming from especially the great field biologists like Jane Goodall and George Schaller and Diane Fossey, who went into the wild and looked at animals living far outside the human sphere, and personality and emotion and intelligence underpinned everything they saw. By the end of the 20th century, more and more scientists were signing on to the notion that, okay, well, all right, chimpanzees can think and feel. Okay, and gorillas. Okay, elephants. But amazingly, dogs did not make the list because scientists saw them as commodities, that they had been these human-manufactured fun products coming out of Victorian England. They could be fluffy, they could be silky, they could do certain things, but they were not somehow authentic animals. So as your colleagues hiked into the rainforest, you know, pursuing the baboons, no self-respecting scientist could study dogs. What were you going to do, you know, crawl under your bed covers at night and see what you had there? This began to change at the very end of the 20th century when it turned out dogs could do some things in the laboratory that chimpanzees were not doing. It began with the simple gesture of pointing. Human children understand pointing starting at around 9 months of age. We point and the baby looks, or the baby points and we look. Even without language, we're communicating. A professor at Emory had the thought that this might be uniquely human. And he did experiments with chimpanzees in which he offered two containers. One container had a treat. The researcher would point to the container with the treat and then invite the chimpanzee to choose. The chimpanzees didn't do any better than chance, even with all this nice information. And the professor was wondering, does this mean pointing is exclusively human? But there was an undergraduate in the lab named Brian Hare, and he said, excuse me, professor, but my dog can do that. And the professor said, oh, right, everyone's dogs can do calculus. But the undergraduate, Brian Hare, went home and made a video of his dog, Oreo. Brian liked to do baseball practice in his backyard. He'd hit the ball, it would fly into a bush. He'd point to the bush, and Oreo would run, get the ball, and bring Brian the ball. They brought Oreo into the lab, hid a treat, held back the dog. Brian pointed to which container, and Oreo ran to it.
Who is Eddie Hill?
Eddie Hill was a sort of down-on-his-luck, sketchy guy living in Columbus, Ohio in the 1990s. And he fell back into the circuit of his old high school gang leader, a man named Duke Palmer. Duke now fancied himself a big-time drug dealer.
Eddie and Duke are involved in a horrific incident in which two people are killed. Duke kills them, but Eddie helps cover up the crime and ends up with a prison sentence of
life.
Life.
Duke was sentenced to death, and Duke was electrocuted. Eddie was sentenced to life in the Warren Correctional Institute.
In Ohio.
Lonely, devastated, cut off from the world. What have I done? My life is over. Then a dog rescue group started bringing in unadoptable dogs into the prison and asking for volunteers to help train them. Eddie seized upon this opportunity and was entrusted with this miserable, terrified fragment of a dog named Timber, whose owner had been so abusive and neglectful that Timber's collar had grown into his neck, and he bore terrible scars. But Eddie loved Timber, and Timber came to love Eddie. Eddie had nurtured Timber so beautifully and given him basic obedience training that Timber turned into this beautiful, obedient dog who was then adopted. Eddie was so attached to Timber and had such a loving bond with him like he'd almost never had in life before. But Timber did so well that it meant Timber was now adoptable. And the day that Eddie had to say goodbye to Timber, knowing he would never see the dog again, although Timber didn't know that, and Eddie, you know, knelt and kissed him and stroked him and said, you're going to have a great life, you're going to be all right. And then he had to stand back as Timber was led away through all of these crashing doors and security systems while Eddie stood there and wept. But then, in this kind of miracle of kindness, a letter arrived from Timber's new owner. The letter ends, Timber is the best dog in the world. I'm so glad to have him. I hope you have the opportunity to train more dogs because you have done an awesome job with Timber. May God bless you. Four Paws for Ability then started a program in this same prison. And Eddie Hill turned out to be the most gifted dog trainer that Four Paws has ever seen behind bars and one of the most gifted dog trainers they've ever seen anywhere. Eddie has trained scores of dogs for children with the most crushing, overwhelming disabilities for children with severe paralysis or autism or seizure disorder. Some children who are multiply handicapped are beyond diagnosis. There are so many challenges. And Eddie's so great at it that relations within the prison have changed. Given how gifted he is, other prisoners will come to him privately and say, can you give me a little help on this one? I'm this lab. I can't find my way with him. And even guards and the warden will come privately to Eddie to ask for advice on one of their pet dogs at home.
Here's what Eddie said, and I'm not sure if this is, and maybe he said this to you. There's no chance in here for the closeness with people like the closeness and total giving that is possible with the dogs. People here are very hesitant to even touch unless it's like a handshake or a fist bump. When somebody's leaving forever, you might give each other a hug, and that's a big deal. With the dogs, there's hugs and kisses galore and total trust almost right away. I wish I'd known about this before I ended up in here.
That's what he told me. Parent groups affiliated with Four Paws are petitioning the Ohio governor's office to take a closer look at parole for Eddie Hill. And Four Paws says they will hire him the first minute he's free, that he has an incredible career ahead of him if the state will simply give him a chance.
You ask some profound questions in your book. Do dogs feel empathy? There's been research on whether dogs feel empathy, whether dogs love, whether they love humans, and it's been done right at Emory University.
A couple of years ago, a flat-faced little pug named Newton died in Atlanta, and his owner, Gregory Burns, was heartbroken, as anyone who has been through this awful thing knows, the grief of losing your beloved dog. And he found himself wondering in his grief, did Newton love me like I love Newton? And then he thought, hey, I'm a neuroscientist at Emory University. I wonder if I could find something out about this. Dr. Burns has access to MRI machines, so he worked with local dog trainers here in Atlanta to train dogs to lie very still in a tube. And with these trained dogs, they offer five different odors. The dog's own odor, nothing. The odor of a strange dog, not much. The odor of a friend dog, some sparkles. There's some sparkles there. There's some pleasure. Strange human, nothing. The odor of the dog's own human, it's the 4th of July. It's fireworks. And he says, we don't know for sure what love looks like. We don't know what it looks like in our own brains. But it's kind of like if this isn't love, we don't know what love is. That's where joy is. The dogs love us. And Dr. Burns wrote a book called Do Dogs Love Us? And this really looks like love.
You also ask a profound question. Do dogs grieve?
I followed the story of a little boy named Connor who was born alive against all odds but presented a dizzying array of challenges, more than could even be diagnosed. It was an extremely, extremely fragile little boy. And at the age of about 4, learned to walk against all odds, was able to speak a few little breathy syllables. He was permanently on a ventilator. So a massive piece of equipment had to be wheeled alongside him wherever he went. But he was terrified of the outside world because the outside world had mostly meant for him medical interventions and emergency trips to the hospital and every kind of needle and scalpel and all the equipment used to keep him alive. So he was afraid to go outside. His doting parents, who treasured this little boy beyond anything else in the world and who feared that he might not have a long life, despaired that he was using up his childhood on the sofa watching Thomas the Train. And they reached out to Four Paws. And this was the beginning of a new world for Connor. They brought home Casey, another big, goofy-looking golden retriever. And Connor fell in love with Casey. And Casey became for Connor everything that Connor was missing in life. A best friend, a little brother, a playmate. Because Casey wanted to go outside, Connor was willing to go outside. And for Connor, it was an adventure just to step a few feet onto the back deck. And then he would stand and sort of threw a ball for Casey. But then Casey would do everything he could with it and romp and mouth the tennis ball and fall down and roll with it and romp all around the backyard, and Connor would laugh.
Connor, of course, went into precipitous decline. He by the time his life ended, he weighed, I think you say, 27 pounds.
I think it was even less, yeah.
I asked you about this in terms of do dogs grieve. Connor died. And in the end of that relationship, unfortunately, Casey had to be kept away from Connor for the most part because he would overwhelm this little boy who was so fragile and so frail, right?
Casey always accompanied Connor to the hospital.
Right.
And he rode in the back seat when the family was going. He rode in the ambulance if it was that urgent. And everyone got to know him. When Connor was getting x-rays, they threw a lead protective vest over the dog. Everyone knew that where Connor went, Casey went. But Casey began feeling more and more protective of Connor because Casey understood that Connor didn't want all these things that were happening to him, and new tubes
put in. The testing in the hospital and the procedures.
Yes, and they were trying to feed him finally through, I think, a vein in his head. And Connor didn't want it, and so Casey didn't want it. And Casey did the unthinkable for a four-paws trained dog. Casey growled at the doctors. He broke training. He was trying to protect Connor. And at that point, they had to take Casey home, and he couldn't go to the hospital anymore with Connor. Nevertheless, every day that Connor was brought home from the hospital was just a red letter day for Casey. And Casey was always phenomenally gentle with Connor. And Casey could make a giant ruckus and prance and rejoice without disturbing Connor. But at the very, very end, when Connor was dying on the sofa, they had to keep Casey away because Casey was freaking out. And then they released Casey when it was over, and Casey raced to Connor's side, but then plodded away, that somehow Connor wasn't there. He kept hoping for that homecoming day, for it to be one of the great days that Connor would come home from the hospital. And Casey paced. He would circle Connor's room and then go to the window to look out. Was Connor coming? Nope. Back to the room. Back to the window. Was Connor coming? No. Back to the and the mom, they were in terrible grief, but it was just unbearable to see this. Casey, stop. Casey, stop. And so Casey would go and sit on her bed for a while, but then she couldn't help it. She started looking for Connor again.
So what is all this that you've researched about these stories led you to believe about dogs and humans?
I feel that what I already felt about dogs, but maybe felt too sheepish, if I may, to admit it, that they are real company, that there is real friendship there, and that when you are in a deep trench for whatever reason, grief or depression or isolation, but there's a dog there and you feel a little better, that's real stuff and universal stuff. So I found it so rewarding and interesting to see that scientists now are all saying, yeah, there's something there. For example, some brand new research that just came out is that if you sit with your beloved dog for a while, your hearts start beating in sync.
Melissa Fay Green, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Bill.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart.
Melissa Fay Green's book is The Underdogs: Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. You can learn more about the book and about Four Paws for Ability by going to the Two Way Street website or our Facebook page.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window?
Now, a quick note about my weekday show, Political Rewind. As the GOP convention gets underway in Cleveland next week, we'll be on the air as usual on Wednesday at 2 and Friday at 3. But we're adding a special convention edition to the GPB radio lineup Tuesday at 2. You'll have three opportunities next week to listen to Political Rewind. Our AJC partner, political writer Jim Galloway, will join us with live reports from the convention. We'll have conversations with delegates, and we'll have some of our regular insiders here in the studio to break down all the action surrounding the convention. I hope you'll join us. Needs a doggy to protect him. That's it for Two Way Street today. Our senior producer is the spectacular Jenny Amond. Our producer is Trevor Young. Our interns are Hannah Rose Adams and Caroline Hayes. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening. See you again next week.
I don't want a bowl of little fishies. He can't take a goldfish for a walk. How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that?